There is a state in the United States that is still governed by the principle of individual responsibility. And so today we pause to ask, what can the state of Jefferson tell us about responsible food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1269th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Buenos Aires who are tuned into the podcast as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, we begin again with Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. When we grow our own food, we have total control over what goes in our food. But when we rely on others thousands of miles away, well, we don't know what goes into our food, and we have very little control over that. Now for a corollary to the second law. When we grow our own food, we are also more capable of managing our own lives than if we rely on somebody else thousands of miles away to grow our food. There is a state in these United States where controlling what goes into one's food and how one manages one's life is still governed by the principle of individual responsibility. That state is the great state of Jefferson, and its citizens lead us to ask, what can the state of Jefferson teach us about responsible food? Who better to ask than Abby Smith, who is a rancher, a writer, a grazer, and the author of this great piece called A Year of Eating Locally in Acres, USA. Abby, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Show.
Thank you so much. It's really fun to be here.
Well, good. Gosh, a mother, a cattle rancher, an Alan Savory-inspired grazer at the Jefferson Hub, and the author of A Year of Eating Locally in Acres, USA. Not much to talk with Abby Smith, about today. Probably we could go on forever and ever here. But first, yeah. Abby Smith, the state of Jefferson. Now, there's no real place called the state of Jefferson, but it exists nonetheless because I've seen it and you live it. Where is it?
So it's supposed to be Northern California and Southern Oregon. And I really honestly am not super involved in it as a political movement, but I know in my region, if you drive around Northern California from Chico and Redding up I-5 and over, if you went up over 299 to our corner of the state, you see a lot of these flags that have the state of Jefferson on them. And I actually, when we were starting our Savory Hub, we thought, oh my goodness, what are we going to call it? Because our region ecologically is so diverse. So how do you choose like one thing? It couldn't be the Sierra Nevada. It couldn't be the Cascades. It was all of these things. And so we thought, wow, there's this real spirit of independence and self-reliance and that is in our region, and we really identified with that culturally. So we called ourselves the Jefferson Center, but not really knowing that there was such a big movement out there.
Well, you know, where I first ran into the state of Jefferson, I was actually scouting a story on survivalists for NBC Magazine with David Brinkley. And I flew a little Cessna into Grants Pass, Oregon Airport. And as the line boy was fueling up the plane and I was giving some instructions, I happened to notice a sign on the top of the hangar. It said, "Welcome to Grants Pass, home of the Jefferson Air Force." And I said to the line boy, "Excuse me, but what is the Jefferson Air Force?" And he looked at me and he shook his head and walked off. And then over his shoulder, he said, "Just don't ask." And of course, if you want to make somebody curious, just say, don't ask about it. So like you, I started seeing the state of Jefferson signs everywhere, on the library, on the bank, just on the fast food franchise. It seemed Jefferson was everywhere. And so I dug into the story a little bit and ended up writing it as a feature story for the San Francisco Chronicle Sunday Magazine. And I titled the piece, Will the North Rise Again? So I have to ask you, do you think the North will rise again and create a real state of Jefferson?
I don't know. I do know that there is that the way you described it, and I was talking about that sense of self-reliance and independence is very strong here. And when you talk to people in our area, they talk about going down to California as if we're not already in California or somewhere else. So I think that culturally people identify in this region with that.
And if you're not in California and you're not in Oregon and you're not in Nevada, where are you?
Well, I guess Modoc County is a different place as well. So I am, and it very much aligns with the spirit of the Jefferson movement, for sure.
Okay, good. Well, you wrote this wonderful article that stopped me in my tracks, and I put it on my pile of very interesting stories to help tell. And your story was about how you and your family and three other families got together and pledged to eat locally for a year. And you began that story with a wonderful account of your daughter and her friend in the forest. Would you tell us, would you relay that story for us? Because it was so beautiful.
Yes, my daughter's name is Maisie, and her little friend Zia, Zia's family was also one of the four families that made this pledge to ourselves and to each other to try eating locally for a year. And Maisie and Zia were out gathering plants to make a stew. They were pretending. And Maisie's 10 and Zia is 7. And this was last summer or last spring. So they were even younger then, and they have these huge imaginations. And I could watch them skipping through, and the sunlight would catch them when they would come through the trees, and they were having so much fun in their little world. And what was so impressive to me as I was listening and watching them is that they knew their plants. They knew that what they could eat and what they couldn't eat, and they saw the landscape and the natural world as a source of nourishment for them. And they knew that they could feed themselves, and they had that, they even incorporated that into their play, that they were going to make this elaborate stew and feed all of us. And I think they actually did make it, and we all survived. That to me was one of the reasons that we did this, is we wanted our children to have that literacy and awareness around where their food comes from and how much your environment can support you if you have a relationship with it, even in a harsh environment like ours up here in far northeastern California.
And of course, for children to have a relationship like that with the land and with the environment really helps to have a mom and dad. So congratulations to you.
Yes.
So what job well done. So the LFX. What does that mean?
So the four families are friends anyway, and we all are really passionate about.
Are you still friends after a year of eating locally?
Yes, we are. We absolutely are. We would get together for dinners here and there, and it was at one of our. We got together to flesh out this idea of, could we do this for a year? Should we try it? What would it look like? And so we got together, and of course we all brought our local food. We had local beef and veggies and grains. We grow wild rice up here, so we can get that in our county. And so it was this beautiful dinner, and we were trying to think of what we would call it. And the kids helped us brainstorm. So each of the families all the families involved had children, and the kids are all friends. And so they were helping us brainstorm names for this. And so we called it the local food experience. So that's the X is for the experience, the local food, the LFX. And the local food challenge and other things were kind of taken. So we wanted to have something that was unique to us. And so we called it LFX.
It sounds high tech, too.
Yeah.
So you launched on this endeavor. How did you start? Where do you start something like this? I mean, if, you know, it'd be really tough for somebody who lives in the inner city of a big metropolitan area, but it's getting easier as we go through time because there are a lot of people producing food for the city now, but you're way out there in the sticks.
We are out there in the sticks. That's very true. We actually live from where my house is right now. I'm at least 23 miles from a grocery store. And then if I wanted to go to more of a supermarket, not like just a local mom and pop store, I'm an hour drive away from that. So we are very isolated in a rural community. But that's normal to us now. So how we started is we got together at that dinner and we created the rules for it. And we at least in our family, we teach and study and practice holistic management. And so in that practice, there's this concept called a holistic context. And that means that you're defining the whole that you're managing, and then you're defining what that needs to be, like what's the greatest expression of itself. So everything is very contextual. So we didn't want to have like anything that we were pushing on each other. And so each family developed their own rules. So when we said, what does it mean to eat local? Each family developed their own answer to that question. But we came up with some really similar themes and that we generally agreed to. And then some were much more strict than others in terms of what they defined as local.
Mm-hmm. So it's a challenge that you define for your own family then. And each family has to, how do you keep track of who's towing the line? Who's the sheriff?
Well, yeah, we didn't make it punitive. It was more of it was very aspirational, and we really held each other accountable. And what we would do is each month we would take turns writing a blog post about what we had learned or something we had gained or some new insight. And there were times when we had slip ups and, you know, within the group and things, and we'd talk about it, we'd write about it. And it really brought us all together closer as friends.
And you have three other families other than yours. Can you give us a very quick thumbnail of who they were? Kind of just a quick thumbnail.
Yeah. Absolutely. So all of us are involved in local food production and local food distribution. And Monoc County, where we live, and within that Surprise Valley specifically, is not a place that you happen to on accident. Like, it's really not on the way to anywhere else. Like this.
And that's why they call it that's why they call it Surprise Valley, right? Because you happen onto it, and there. So we're going to have to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to go on this great. What did you call it?
What is that?
The experience, right?
Oh, LFX?
Yes, the LFX. We're going to have an experience of what it's like to eat locally for a year. And folks, these folks know how to feed themselves in the first place, so it's going to be a great adventure. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Abby Smith and you. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back to eating locally, and we're way up there in the Surprise Valley, which is way up at the northeast corner of California. Not so many beach boys up there, ladies and gentlemen. Not so many surfboards either, I suspect. A different California. It's more in line of the state of Jefferson than the state of California. And if I'm sure that every state has its own neck of the woods that could be a good state of Jefferson. It's where people really take getting along in the world as a personal responsibility. And it's an ethic. It's a way of life. And not so reliant on the big government to take care of them. And would that be a good description, Abby Smith?
Absolutely.
And so there's the four families in the Surprise Valley who endeavor to eat locally for a year. They make their own rules and regulations for each family. But by and large, you're a group of people that know how to grow food, correct? And not only grow food, but you're involved in the community's local food programs to a great extent.
Yes. So the story there is that, again, Modoc County and Surprise Valley is not really someplace that you just decide to live because it's convenient or it has a really good job. And so your job brought you there. Like you might go to other more metropolitan areas. Like you either, sounds bad, but you're either running from something or you're very intentionally living here. So we have it's a very eclectic, small community. And or, you know, you've lived here for generations and your family have been ranchers or Native Americans and your roots are here. So I fall into the category of the intentional living transplant into Surprise Valley, as did actually all of the families, now that I think about it. None of us are Native American, and we are not also coming from that lineage of ranchers in the community as well.
Oh, then before you take another step, tell us about the culture shock of moving to the Surprise Valley from wherever you came from. Well, it must have been a big surprise.
Mm-hmm. Funny. I grew up in Plumas County in Northern California in a place called Indian Valley and Taylorsville, Quincy, and those are the towns in that general area. So I was used to rural living, but this is a deeper degree of rural than I grew up with, even growing up on a ranch and in a small town as well. I actually spent time in Africa after I graduated from Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo. And there was something about Surprise Valley and Modoc County that made me feel like I was, like my heart was in Africa still. And there's something wild and open about it that I love. And so for me, I bonded early with the community and with the landscape. And I think sometimes when things are hard, I wonder, like, why am I choosing to live on the edge of civilization where I literally haul my water and I have to get firewood and all those things. I'm like, I could live in a place that was a little bit easier, but I also love the fact that I can step out my front door and in 10 minutes I'm on a trail in the wilderness, and I love to run. And so I think there's always the trade-offs, and it's not for everyone. Like, we don't have the convenience of even grocery stores nearby. We have or gas stations. We have a post office and a little hotel and restaurant in Port Bidwell, where I live at the north end of Surprise Valley. And that's all in terms of amenities. We also have a post office, but I need to drive 23 miles to the nearest grocery store or gas station, mm-hmm. and then an hour to a larger store. And then if you want these novel things like big box stores and things like that, you have to go at least 2.5 hours.
So did the others in your community find it easy to adjust as well as you did?
I think that we all chose, all the families very intentionally chose to be here, and we had to work hard to be here. Zia's mom, they left and then came, really intentionally came back and had to find property and find jobs. And it's not just like you find a job, you have to build a business and everything here. And so I think we all wanted to be here. And so.
So you made the sacrifices to be there then.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like in a way there's so much openness that we built the community that we wanted with each other.
Mm-hmm. And part of that community that seems to tie the four families together is your participation in the local food movement. And when, when you live 2.5 hours away from the nearest box store, community food must be really important then.
Yeah, food security is a big deal in places like this where we wouldn't, I imagine if there was a food shortage, we wouldn't be high on the priority list because we are so remote and our population is so low. And so, and we're also, because of the food access or, you know, roadways and things that we could easily be cut off from supply. There's really only two ways to come into the valley from the west, and those are all over mountain passes, and then you can go south to Nevada, but or north to Oregon, but you're going to hit some rough roads there as well. So
In your piece in Acres USA, your daughter Maisie made a real interesting comment at the end of the season. You know, you asked her for her opinion, and she says, "Well, you know, when it gets right down to it, we were really prepared for the pandemic. Didn't even know it was here."
Right. Yes, it's really true. And this group of us had been involved in creating a local food movement here prior to our local food year. And it was really, we wanted to walk the talk or put our money where our mouth is or whatever, you know, analogy you want to use. But we were advocating for this. And so we're like, we're going to do it to show what we learn and help others make it more accessible, even in their minds, that this can be done, or even if you do it to a small degree. And so that was the impetus behind that. But we were all part of forming what we call Modoc Harvest, which is our local food hub, where farmers and ranchers and market gardeners can sell to the food hub, and then it's distributed to community members. And so we came up with the concept and did all the business analysis and everything. And then that was, that got started and is still going, which we're really proud of. So I feel like the conditions were created for resiliency for many years leading up to the pandemic. And luckily, I guess for us, we were already in these habits of looking to our local community for our food source and had done the work really to prepare for that. And so, yeah, a lot of ways that's very true when that first initial shock of the shutdowns and everything, we didn't really feel that here.
Already shut down and taking care of yourselves anyway, so what the heck, over. I noticed that the four of your farms grow a varied product line, have a number of different things. Nobody's growing 1,000 acres of tomatoes, for example. You're all growing a varied number of products, and a lot of them are based around animal husbandry as well.
Correct. Yes, so Springs Ranch produces grass-fed beef, and we had our own little garden. That where we are located is pretty prime country for livestock because it's of our growing season. It's harder to grow things like tomatoes and other amazing things they can grow in other parts of California. And then our neighbors, Brian and Leah, they have Bidwell Canyon Farm. They're amazing gardeners and grow a whole variety of vegetables. And they also have goats and chickens. And then Jess and Kermit have also a market garden, and they put in a hoop house as part of that. Jess is an amazing gardener, and they have chickens and goats as well. And then our friends Owen and Hannah, they have Down the Mountain Farmstead. They're actually in Nevada in Washoe County, so they're on the other side of the valley from us, but very much part of the Surprise Valley community because there is really nothing else on the Nevada side. in terms of a town.
You don't really see any line in the sand anyway, do you, between California and Nevada up there?
There's a sign on the gravel road that says "Welcome to Nevada," but that's pretty much your own indication. Yes. Good. So they have they raised pastured pork out there, as well as having hoop houses and veggies and everything. So mm-hmm. we were in pretty good shape.
So it sounds like, with respect to food, you had mm-hmm. lots of meat, lots mm-hmm. of vegetables. But what did you do in the winter?
Well, the winter was challenging. We the other thing was that it wasn't within Surprise Valley, but within our county, within Modoc County, is the Alturas Ranches, and it's one of the largest, I think it's one of the largest land holdings in California, but they also grow wild rice. And so we had some grain. Our family ate very much more of a paleo diet. Our daughter's gluten-free, and I can't eat any grains due to health conditions and things that I was working through. And so it wasn't we didn't miss bread and things like that. But we did have another grower in the valley start producing local wheat, so they could buy the wheat and then mill it, you know, on small batches in the household. Mm-hmm. So in the winter, we did a lot of prepping. So there was lots of canning, lots of freezing, lots of preserving of food, and a lot of trading. My friend Jess, who was part of this, she would make this amazing sourdough bread, made out of buckwheat, and then whatever we could find, and then we would trade that for meat or eggs or things like that. But yeah, winter wasn't as hard as I thought it would be, but it was scarier going into fall, not knowing if we had prepped enough food to get through it with all the canning and drying and everything.
One of my all-time favorite photographs is that of my grandmother in her root cellar. And she must have had hundreds of mason jars, all different colors of everything mm-hmm. that she had been canning. And I just looked at that. I thought, winter's going to be okay. She'll make it just fine.
It is a
great feeling to have to be prepared for winter. So you have that, and it must have been a great feeling. Then, mm-hmm. So a lot of trading back and forth. How did you conduct those trades? Is it cash? Is it, do you barter? How do you do that?
It's all barter, which is so much fun. That's very typical here. Like in Surprise Valley, potlucks are a really big deal. Like it's just how people gather and socialize. And there's a lot of really good cooks in the area, and that, and then bartering is a big deal. So those were things that were already culturally really accepted. And we just took them we amplified them through our program. But it's funny, every barter has its own characteristics, I guess, but you just decide what, you know, like we had a lot of honey on the ranch too, because bees would come, they would, like the beekeepers would park their bees there for the off season, and they were used as pollinators down in the Sacramento and Central Valleys. And then they would come here, and the honey was just a byproduct. And so they would give us tons of honey. And honey, if you buy it in the store, special local raw honey, is very expensive. And so we had this, it was like gold, like, oh my gosh, we have this bartering, you know, supply that we could then trade. And so, yeah, I don't even know if there's a formula or rules to it, but you just say, hey, I've got this, you want to trade for this, and then you decide how much. And it's usually, at least here in this community, it's very generous. So, and I think that's why bartering works, mm-hmm. is that people are generous. And it's not like, well, I didn't really think I got enough, but you always feel like you got more than you gave.
And very important to be generous with your barter and with your deals with when you're living in a small community like that, because if you're the person that wants to get every last nickel out of a deal, people aren't going to want to trade with you, right?
Right. It doesn't work. It really doesn't work. And I realized that was my big aha from the local food year, is that there's no way that I could, due to my abilities, not the geography or anything, but I just couldn't grow everything that we needed. And so it really took a community. Like, there's this network of other people that sustain you. And it, even in this idea of like real self-reliance, we can't ignore our interconnectivity. And that was a real eye-opener for me, and how powerful that was, that it was the community and the relationships that were sustaining us.
That's one of the things your daughter Macy made a few comments about, was how much fun it was to barter.
Oh, yeah, she loves it. Yes, absolutely.
And it's a great education in doing business when it gets right down to it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And how did the other kids fare? It sounds like Macy had the time of her life. She was 10, right?
10, yeah. Yeah, she, 9. She was 9 when we were going through it. We did it from, summer solstice in 2019 is when we started, and we ended on summer solstice 2020.
Okay, so going to have to take a quick break. Fortunately, we have something to take a break for. There's some very important messages. When we come back, I'd like to talk about the lessons learned from a year of eating locally in a place where it probably is just about as easy to eat locally as not to, when it gets right down to it. If you have to drive 2.5 hours to the nearest box store, it would seem like it would be a good thing to do to eat locally. We will be right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it.
on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Right back. Here we are, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. And today we're talking about a year of eating locally with the good folks, Abby Smith. And there were four families up there in Surprise Valley, way up there in the northeast corner of California. A place not like Malibu. Not like San Francisco. And when the world thinks of California, they think of beaches and whatnot. But here's a place that's more akin to my home country of Montana and the great state of Jefferson. And a year of eating locally. So must have been some very significant lessons learned during that time. Let's start off and kind of go through the ranches and the farms and see what was learned. Let's go to the Mountain Farmstead. Tell us a little bit about what they learned in this process.
So that's Owen, Hannah, Clavey, and Cole, the two sons and the mom and dad. And they were the most extreme in their rules. And so I think their rules were they only bought salt, olive oil, and baking soda or something really minimalist like that, and then the rest of it had to come from the county, from Modoc County. And so, but they are such hard workers and they are such a great team. The boys are young, they're my daughter's age, and they jump right in and help with their parents, and they did a ton of preserving. And when we talked after the food year ended, their big surprise was that the amount of plastic that suddenly re-entered their lives. When you go to the grocery store, you realize like everything is wrapped in plastic. And it was really disheartening for them to realize, how much when you go to any store, you're really consuming basically a ton of plastic, and they didn't like that. And then also that they could, distinguish between, with the boys that this is food, this is where your food comes from, and that you can always choose other things, but you know the difference.
You know, backing up to the plastics, we city people, of course, we're covered in plastics. We're probably drowning in plastics when it gets right down to it. And cardboard boxes now, too, because they're all coming to the front porch now. Plastics, food wrapped in plastic and covered in cardboard. But yet, if you think about a place like Surprise Valley, where you can see great distances and a bit of plastic floating down the road would kind of be distressing. And if you think about how much plastic there is, how do you keep all the plastic from the land? Is that something that's really a prime consideration from the community?
It definitely is within our network of friends, and we're concerned about it locally and globally. I think that it's just, there's no place for it to go, and it's interfering with all of our natural systems, including our own bodies. But so I think in general, that's a value that we share, is not being, overdoing the consumption.
Yeah.
But also not trying to be elitist as well.
And speaking of consumption, down in the mountain, folks, down the mountain farmstead had some trouble with cutting out coffee and chocolate too, right?
Yeah. And then they allowed that back in and they made that exception. So after about 3 months into it, they're like, we're going to make some exceptions. And each family had their exception that they would make, and so that was one of theirs that they decided.
Well, did this become a confessional at the potlucks when you got together? the exception stories.
There definitely were like, we fell off the wagon there or here, and but a lot of it was focused on what we were learning. Like, oh my gosh, did you see this recipe? And like Via could make this egg tortilla, like I don't know where she got the recipe, but it was like this perfect texture and thickness, and she was So every time she'd come over, she would make her little egg tortilla.
And how old was she?
She's 7.
Wow. And she had something very valuable to contribute to the world, right? Egg tortillas.
Yes. Egg tortillas, yes. And it was a hit. And then, you know, it was so fun because she had, I think there's recipes out there, but she invented it, you know, according to the story. And so, she was very proud. And the cooking skills of the kids is amazing. I didn't know that at all. Even when I went to college, it just wasn't, you know, I grew up on the generation of box cereals and low-fat yogurt and things like that.
So the kids are discovering. You mentioned the boys, the 10-year-old boys, getting into the process of helping the family. Weren't they a little bit leery of this notion of going without candy?
they might have thought that, but I've never seen kids eat like this. Like they love to, Maya from Bidwell Canyon Farm, her favorite thing is dill. So she'll just go out into the garden in the summertime and her mouth is just green because she eats so much dill. And the kids eat salad like it's pizza, and they don't think about it. They don't realize how they have healthy habits, which I think is wonderful because it's not a thing. It's just how it is. It's mm-hmm. just how we eat, you know?
So, and you know, when it gets right down to it, when you get off sugar for quite a while, you just don't need sugar to the extent that you needed sugar before. What about the folks at Bidwell Canyon Farm? What did they learn?
Well, so it's Brian and Leah are the mom and dad, and then Zella and Maya are the two girls. And they homeschool, and then during that time, the girls were still going an hour away to the nearest town, which is Alturas, for dance class and things like that. And Leah said that she didn't realize how much time it took to prepare food. And so the prepping of the meals and getting snacks, it's hard to make, it's easy to make meals. It's harder to make snacks when you're doing a local food diet. And so she felt like when they would struggle with keeping to their own rules and everything was around, oh my gosh, we got to go to town and we need to grab something quick. And what can that be? And so food prep was a challenge.
Sure. An exception story then.
Yes.
And they also had trouble with good fats, which I think a lot of people probably have trouble finding good fats. It's easy to find bad fats, but not so easy to find good fats.
Yeah, we definitely couldn't find, we could not, you know, if you wanted to eat bad fats, you couldn't do it locally because those are usually highly processed and from monocrops grown in the Midwest. And so luckily that's not here, but we made lard from down the mountain farmstead pigs. And it's actually so easy. And that's one thing that I realized is a lot of the bigger preparation things like making bone broth and making lard, it's not that hard. You just have to be around to check it and things like that. But so for our family, it wasn't so bad. And then we followed what we called the bullseye diet. And that was where we wanted to get most of our food from our local community. And then it would radiate out from there. And so some things would come from our region, some things from our state, and then very few things like maybe turmeric or cinnamon would come from far, far away because that just doesn't grow here. Mm-hmm. And so that was the rules that we followed and as well as the Bidwell Canyon Farm. And so we have a friend in Vacaville, Alexis Kofed, who has Soul Food Farm, and she produces olive oil and she practices holistic management and regenerative agriculture. And she's a friend. And so we would go down in our travels for our work and we would bring home cases of olive oil. And then we would have that to barter with and then also use for ourselves. So we didn't struggle so much with that. We would use olive oil and lard predominantly and then some coconut oil, obviously, which is farther away. Mm-hmm. But that would be, you know, within our bullseye diet, which we felt was something we could sustain for a year.
Mm-hmm. And then the folks from Wild Rose Farms talked about how the kids were always hungry. You'd made references to snacks. And, of course, kids are always eating, right?
So Zia and then her little brother, Wilder, is the same age as my son.
I love the name Wilder.
Yes, I know. It's very appropriate for him. I think that what she was referring to, at least from my recollection, is that kids just, some kids tend to eat kind of continuously, like they're grazers, and so they want more snacks throughout the day versus like larger meals and stuff. And they're, when you're little, you know, they eat, that's more typical of how they eat. And so it was harder to keep, again, those snacks prepared and those little foods. But Jess is such a good cook, and she, you know, she would create, she made like a summer sausage and some salamis, and she would have meatballs ready to go, and she made goat cheese and everything from her milk. And so I think that all of the families did so much better than they give themselves credit for in filling those gaps. And just really, it's basically thinking differently. And so instead of asking yourself, like, what's easiest, what can I get? You say, you know,
stick this in your mouth and shut up, right? Wasn't like that.
Yeah, wasn't like that, no. But for us, we had different lessons based on, you know, our own context and our own rules as well.
So what about you and your family? What about the Smith family at Springs Ranch?
Yeah, so we really discovered foraging through that. So we were following the bullseye diet. We had plenty of meat from ourselves and then from our friends, and enough vegetables through our own garden and trading and things like that. And then making our own fats. But we discovered dock is a common, what would be considered a weed. And we somehow realized that you could eat the seeds, and I think the roots too, but we only tried the seeds. And so my daughter and I made a dock flour, and then we made like little dock cookies out of it. And she has this adorable cooking video where she teaches everyone how to harvest and then cook or make these dock flour cookies. And they're actually good. Like they weren't bad at all. So that was a fun discovery, to be able to eat something that we once considered a weed. And so it opens your eyes to the plants around you. And then we actually made these dandelion fritters. So we would, and this was on the ranch, and the ranch is certified organic, so we weren't worried about pesticides and things like that. But when the dandelions came out in the spring, we would pick the blossoms, and then it's like a deep fried dandelion. So we would kind of do them with egg and a little batter and fry them in fat, and they were amazingly delicious. So we are really excited about dandelion season this year.
Well, you've done the impossible, which is to get my mouth watering about dandelions. Wow.
it's so good.
So what surprised you, Abby Smith, and what surprised all of you the most about this experiment of eating locally for a whole year?
I think for all of us, we realized how abundant our region is. And we have, most of us grow up in what's called a food desert, where there just isn't local food produced. And it's so possible and it's so attainable. It's so much easier and more abundant than we thought, which surprised me. I thought, you know, you picture like these pioneer people and they're struggling and winter is so hard. And it just wasn't like that. That, again, back to the point about community, that if you do have a good community and you have a barter system and you have a network, there's this amazing abundance and diversity, and that it really does take a community to make it work.
Do you think it possible that a food community such as you have up there in the Surprise Valley in the great state of Jefferson could be transplanted to metropolitan areas? Is there any reason why it couldn't?
I don't think so. I think it's a shift. It's a mental shift in asking different questions about your food, and then also putting out that demand or that desire. And there are lots of producers that serve metropolitan areas with vegetables and meats and everything. And I don't think it's possible with livestock, but you can grow so much in small gardens and things. And then once you start trading and you can develop that network, oh my goodness, because there's so many more people, there's so much more potential for trading.
Abby Smith, you're also a grazer with the Allen Savory Jefferson Hub. And I absolutely insist that you join me on the food chain for a discussion of grazing and how grazing might be used to regenerate our earth. Deal?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
All right. Abby Smith, thank you so much for joining us. Folks, remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.